Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more prolific scholar at MTSU than Dr. John Vile, Dean of the University Honors College, political scientist, and constitutional expert. The book we're talking about today is The Men Who Made the Constitution, Lives of the Delegates to the Constitutional Convention, from Scarecrow Press. He takes each of the delegates from Abraham Baldwin to Robert Yates and peers into their lives before and after the convention. We'll learn about some founding fathers you probably didn't learn about in school after a preamble from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. ExpressJet, a Georgia-based aviation company, has hired six alumni of the MTSU Aerospace program as flight instructors. Paul Mosey, MTSU's chief flight instructor, said it was the first time ExpressJet ventured to a university for a mass interview. The Baldwin Photographic Gallery is featuring an exhibit by photographic artists Jerry Yulsman and Maggie Taylor through March 9th in the Learning Resources Center. The exhibit, which includes 25 prints, kicks off the gallery's 50th year at MTSU. And MTSU's Todd Art Gallery is kicking off the spring 2014 semester with Shoebox, an international sculpture exhibition which will be on display through February 14th, showcasing works by artists and academics from across the U.S., Australia, and Europe. The exhibit features sculptural renderings that fit in a shoebox. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com.
Welcome back, John. It's been too long. The careers and personalities of the signers of the Declaration of Independence are fabled in story and song, but we hear relatively little in pop culture about the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. Why is that?
Well, or better yet, or worse yet, we often get them confused. A lot of people think that Jefferson must have been in on the writing of the Constitution, or John Adams must have been there, and of course they were not. But many lesser figures and some pretty important ones were there as well.
Now, how much academic scholarship is available to be perused about these men?
I would say there are a good 8 or 10 books that deal with the delegates. A number of them deal only with the signers, of which there were 39. I deal with all 55. Most of the early books have very little on families, and there has been some published on that recently. So I've tried to include, you know, information about where they lived and how many children they had and name of their house if there was one, that sort of thing. My primary emphasis is actually what they did at the convention, but as you say, I try to give their backgrounds before. And then a lot of them have some pretty interesting careers afterward as well.
There is some crossover between the two groups.
There is.
The Declaration signers or the people who attended the Second Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention
and
delegates.
And there are a couple, I cannot remember, although I may have an appendix in the back, there are a handful that have signed like three of the documents, signed the Articles of Confederation, the Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, and the U.S. Constitution.
Why are there relatively few who were at both the Declaration and the Constitution groups?
Well, remember, it's an 11-year time difference. In some ways, they're different generations. Progressives used to charge that the Declaration was very democratic and the Constitution, you know, was less so. I really don't think there's that much division, but there is a difference in terms of, you know, those who grew up with the primary rhetoric being overthrow the British have a somewhat different perspective than those who are around during the Articles of Confederation that don't seem to be working too well and are more interested in the need perhaps to strengthen the national government.
Well, the Articles of Confederation with a relatively weak executive is understandable given the fact that they had just said, forget you, to the King of England.
Well, sure. And remember, you know, the term state that we use today is ambiguous. When political scientists use it, they're usually referring to a nation state. And there was some, you know, in some respects, the 13 colonies were almost as close to independent nations as to what we today would consider to be states.
The way the book is arranged enables the reader to look up delegates individually, and the introduction has analyses of the delegates, but you did it by region instead of by state. Why?
Well, I mean, you can do it any number of ways. And, you know, one of the things I had to figure out was, you know, do I do it by state or do I do it alphabetically? And I think what I ended up doing, we did them alphabetically, but then I had a little table of contents that also divided them by states. Some states had very specific interests, but by and large you can divide them into what they call the East, what today we'd call the North or the Northeast, your middle states and your southern states. And they had different climates. They had somewhat different religious traditions. Of course, the biggest division and the one that, they did the most in somewhat – well, the biggest division at the convention was actually between the large and the more populous and the least populous. But the one that they did the most to paper over was, of course, the division between the slave states and the free.
Mm-hmm. James Madison, as you well know, is nicknamed the father of our Constitution. Do you think that nickname is well-deserved?
He's as prominent as any of the delegates there. I would say he is probably the most influential delegate. He himself did not use the term and made a point of saying, this is a collective product. And part of it was, of course, he's a person who believes very much in small R republicanism, which is sort of representative democracy. And so the notion that, in contrast to let's say the Ten Commandments, or in contrast maybe better to some of the Greek city-states where they'd bring in an outside person, a Solon or somebody like right. that, and have like Hergus, and have them write their laws and then go away. This was intended to be a collective product in part because it was thought, this is the only kind of product that the people will assent to.
Moses the lawgiver is okay. Madison the lawgiver is not.
I think that's right, and it's certainly not a role that he ever claimed or that he would have wanted.
But you seem to just imply that he was called the father of the Constitution in his time. This is not something that historians tagged him with after the fact.
Well, he had someone who wrote to him calling him the father, and he disclaimed it. It's become more popular since then, but I think the better term, which wasn't coined, if I remember, until Harding, was founding fathers. And, it is one. The only thing I don't like about it is it sounds a little chauvinistic, but as a matter of fact, there were only men delegates at the time, and the only state that permitted some women to vote was New Jersey.
Other than Madison, which delegate do you think made the most positive and lasting contributions to the Constitution?
Let's go back to Madison a minute. He's primarily gets credit because he's believed to be the primary author of the Virginia Plan. He's also the person who took the best notes at the convention. So any scholar is indebted because two-thirds of what you read are notes that Madison took.
And explain the Virginia Plan before you move forward.
Right. The Virginia Plan was the first plan that was proposed at the convention, and most of the delegates had arrived thinking that they were simply going to modify the Articles of Confederation, which was a one branch government with a unicameral Congress, no independent president, no independent judiciary. And Madison introduced this fairly radical plan, which called for a bicameral Congress in which both houses were represented according to population, an independent president, an independent judiciary, and the like. But the person whose presence was probably most important to the convention was George Washington. He said very little, but he presided over the proceedings, and he seems to have lent an element of solemnity and dignity to the occasion. James Wilson of Pennsylvania was quite influential. Governor Morris is the one who talked the most. And talking at an event like that can be fairly important.
He's at the president for the filibuster.
Well, just about, yes.
It sounds as though George Washington's presence there was sort of that of the icon, the rock star, Nelson Mandela, if you will, the towering figure to which everyone could look up.
And there were actually two. The other was Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was not in particularly good health. Franklin seems to have played the role primarily of conciliator. He was a person when everybody would get heated, he'd say, well, maybe we ought to consider starting our next session with prayer, or he'd give some kind of homey little analogy. But yes, Washington and Mandela, I think there are a good number of comparisons between them. They're both we can dispute whether Madison was father of the Constitution, but I think nobody disputes that George Washington was father of his country. And the fact that, Washington probably could have proclaimed himself king and he chose not to gave a lot of assurance to people that if he's in charge, then, remember, the proceedings were secret. So, you know, what's going on? And the response is, well, you know, Washington's in charge. He'll see to it that our liberties are protected.
Washington took the Cincinnati approach.
He did, very much.
I have done my job. I'm not going to make a career out of it.
Well, and, you know, and then again, and again, you have a parallel to Mandela. I don't think, you know, we forget that in the original Constitution, there were no term limits on the president. You could serve an unlimited number of terms. And had he continued past his second term, he may very well have set a dangerous precedent for us. And as it was, you know, the precedent lasted till Franklin Roosevelt and was eventually embodied in a constitutional amendment.
There was nothing whatsoever governing Washington about that except his integrity and common sense.
Exactly. Well, and perhaps his frustration by the end of his second term.
Okay, Adams, it's all yours. Get in there. We'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
Expanding Your Horizons is an annual hands-on science and math conference for middle and high school girls. EYH enables girls to investigate careers in science and math and to talk with female leaders in those fields that are so essential to our nation's future. EYH also provides the girls with fun hands-on activities and allows them to meet girls with similar interests. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, EYH Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. John Vial, Dean of the University Honors College, about his book, The Men Who Made the Constitution, Lives of the Delegates to the Conventional Constitution. Now, let's dig into the quirks of some of these individuals, and some of them were pretty quirky.
They were.
Who was Gunning Bedford Jr., and why did he stand before the entire convention and tell the delegates he did not trust them?
Well, he was a Delaware delegate, and Delaware had actually come with instructions that they were not to negotiate on the issue of state equality. And so when Madison put forward this proposal that states ought to be represented by population, he made that comment, and the comment, and frankly, it wasn't much different from a comment that Governor Morris made on the other side, but he essentially said, you know, if you guys, if you guys won't do this voluntarily, we may have to ally ourselves with a foreign power. And again, that's as, you know, radical as it seems today, it's not inconsistent with the notion that many of the states almost considered themselves to be separate nations.
You had to be there in order to understand the vibe going
Indeed.
On at that time.
Indeed. And he was a lawyer, and he did later get up and apologize. He said, you know, that came with his profession. It was a profession that requires vigorous advocacy.
Okay. We have to talk about William Blount, after whom I understand Blount County, Tennessee, is
named.
It was.
He's probably the closest connection that Tennessee has to the convention.
Although he represented North Carolina, technically.
He did. And interestingly, on that same point, you know, the three presidents that Tennessee claims were all born in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the first time we got a foreign input. He was not particularly influential at the Constitutional Convention, and frankly, my own judgment is that he was not a terribly great statesman. He one of the people who wrote about him said something to the effect that he always asked what his country could do for him rather than what he could do for his country.
Well, what do you expect from a guy who showed up late to the convention because he had a bad case of hemorrhoids?
Well, I actually give him a little sympathy on that point.
Well, yeah, that's true. After all, he would have had to ride horseback, probably.
Indeed. Transportation was different then.
But he also wrote part of the Tennessee State Constitution later on.
He did. And I believe there's a house that you can tour in Knoxville to this day for him. One of the people that I found was, I thought, underappreciated at the convention and has something of a local tie was Hugh Williamson. Williamson County, of course, is named after him. Williamson, next to Franklin, was probably one of the brightest scientists in the country. He had done pieces. He had done a lot of astronomical work. He had written treatises on comets and the like, and was fairly he also was from North Carolina, was fairly influential, probably what we would consider to be the head of that delegation.
Now, why was Blount, after he became a United States senator, impeached?
You know, here's where I need to go back and read my own book.
Okay.
My recollection is that there were some thoughts that maybe he was involved in the Burr controversy, or you know, one of the controversies as to whether, you know, whether they were trying to form an alliance with, you know, of states of their own in the West, but I could be mistaken on that. One of the fascinating things is I believe he's the only senator ever to be impeached. And they subsequently, you know, you looked at the Constitution and said, well, there's already, there's a constitutional provision that you can get rid of us. The Senate can get rid of its own members by a two-thirds vote. And it's thought that impeachment, you know, the general feeling now is that impeachment is for officials who cannot otherwise be tossed out, presidents, cabinet officers, and the like.
We'll take another break here, and we'll be right back. This is MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about The Men Who Made the Constitution, a book by Dr. John R. Vial about the delegates to the Constitutional Convention in the United States. You mentioned Gouverneur Morris. We'll
yes.
go back to him. He was quite a character. He had a withered arm and an artificial leg, but women still loved him.
Absolutely.
And he did not lack for respect at the convention, did he?
No, he did not. And he was a fairly successful diplomat over in France later and in other places. He once stood in for a sculpture as a double for George Washington.
He was of that stature?
He was. He was about the same height and about the same, you know, frame. I'm not sure what they did with the leg, I guess, the big leg that he had. But and even that, you know, he apparently had done it in a carriage accident, but he wasn't at all disturbed when the rumor got out that maybe he had jumped out a second story building, you know, because somebody's husband had returned. One of the things they really respected was the power of oratory. And rhetorically, apparently there were few that were much more gifted than Morris was.
And you can read, for example, some of the speeches that George Washington gave. And George Washington was not considered to be a magnificent orator, but they are so much more eloquent than many modern writings that you think if he was one of the intellectual lesser lights of his era, my goodness, that means
well, I'll give you a little caution that with Washington, often his speeches were primarily ghostwritten by Madison or Hamilton later.
I see.
But you do, you know, if you look at the private letters that he sent, which presumably he did write, there's a certain elegance of tone which I think is fairly lacking in a telephone internet age.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sign too many things, LOL or that kind of whatever.
Would you attribute that to his intellect or just his sincerity, his authenticity?
I think a lot of it was, you know, self-discipline. A lot of it was Washington was one of those people who apparently had a sense, not a bad sense, but a sense that he was playing a part and that he needed to play it, you know, requisite to what was expected. And again, you made an analogy earlier to Nelson Mandela, and it's probably pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
He realized that everything he said or did would become a kind of precedent, and he wanted to make sure it was in the proper direction.
Break time again. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle East-centered MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
The book is by Dr. John Vial, Dean of the University Honors College and Constitutional Law Scholar. It's called The Men Who Wrote the Constitution. Now, poor George Wythe, after whom a
yes.
county in Virginia is named. Very accomplished man.
Absolutely.
First professor of law in America.
Yes.
Taught John Marshall, Thomas Jefferson, and James Monroe, chaired the convention's rules committee, only to end up being poisoned to death by a nephew.
He was. Now, and not only that, he got a chance to be on the rules committee at the very beginning of the convention, but he left after about a week and a half or 2 weeks because his wife was dying. have a funny little story about Wythe. The law school at William & Mary is named the Marshall Wythe Law School after he and John Marshall. And they have a statue of Wythe out front, both of them. And under Wythe, there's a comment that he educated all these men, including James Madison. And so after I sent my daughter there to law school, I wrote a little note saying, you know, I knew quite a bit about James Madison, but did not know he had studied under Wythe. And I got this note back saying, well, it wasn't that James Madison. It was James Madison, Bishop of the Episcopal Church.
They just chose not to differentiate between the two.
They did not. And one of my daughter was later in a class being taught by the dean, and he was telling about this wacky parent who had written to them. Turned out to be her dad. So.
Somebody from the Department of Marketing and Communications must have gotten a hold
probably
of that.
Probably so.
Yeah. For whom did you write this book? Is it for academics, college students, history buffs, or all of the above?
Probably all of the above. You know, I had previously written a book called The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, as well as an encyclopedia. The encyclopedia was primarily designed for reference libraries. Some of this, a good bit of the skeleton, was taken from some of the sketches that I did there. But I realized that within the 7 or 8 years since I did that encyclopedia that quite a bit of new information was coming out. And I actually am currently working on a book on one of the delegates from Georgia by the name of William Pierce, about whom so far, well, there's a book of his collected writings that just came out. But not real, you know, with an introductory essay, but there's really no book about him out there right now.
What about Pierce captured your interest?
Primarily, he was sort of a predecessor here. He was a delegate who wrote up, and I can't remember if it was all but two or three, but he wrote sort of sketches on each of the delegates who had attended. And what's fascinating about it is he had actually studied under one of America's premier portraiture artists. And we don't, to our knowledge, we don't know that there are any of his portraits or other paintings that remain. But what we do have are these very incisive verbal descriptions of delegates who were there. And I guess partly it was like, well, if he was interested, you know, he was actually the first person to do what I'm doing in this book, which is to tell us a little bit about most of the participants.
So he was sort of secretary of the committee or a journalist?
Almost a journalist. He really didn't participate. He was only there about a month, and he didn't participate that much. But he seemed to have a fairly sharp eye or ear in some cases. And one of the things that particularly fascinated me is I've always been interested in the rhetoric of the Founding Fathers. And he often made comments about, you know, whether they were long-winded or whether they had an accent or whether they made good logical sense and the like.
Obviously, there were no attendance rules, and you couldn't have enforced them anyway, right?
That's right. And, it, you know, in some cases, the New Hampshire delegate didn't get there till very late because they weren't appointed and they weren't paid till fairly late. You know, it's a time where, you know, if you were a farmer, you might need to get home at the end of August or early September before the convention was over to take care of things. People had health issues. Some people, of course, left because they were disgusted. They thought it was headed in the wrong direction.
Well, how were the delegates paid, given that the lack of a common currency was one of the problems in the Articles of Confederation?
You know, I should review that because I'm not sure that I remember whether they were – I believe they were paid individually by their states. And, in fact, one of the issues they had to deal with, you know, members of the first of the Congress under the Articles of Confederation were paid by their individual states. And one of the things that the U.S. Constitution did was standardize that so that if you had a state that didn't have a lot of money or was farther away or poorer, that they could still afford to send representatives.
We'll be back in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE Advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
In our remaining moments with Dr. John Vial, author of The Men Who Made the Constitution, You've written so many books about the founding fathers. Why does this initial period of American history fascinate you more than any other?
Well, it set the stage. I mean, we have the world's longest, as a nation, the world's longest written constitution. I actually have a book coming out next year called, and I don't know if I have the title in front of me, but it's a book on, the Reframers, and it discusses 170-some people who have proposed major alternatives and in some cases entirely new constitutions to the one we have now. Interestingly, a number of states are calling right now for a subsequent constitutional convention. And I guess, when I look at these delegates, there are a couple that were fairly non-entities, but I think it'd be very difficult to assemble a group of 55 people today that had the stature and the political experience that many of these men did. Part of it is, they were coming out of something of a crisis time. Even those who favored strong states' rights could generally agree that the Articles of Confederation did not vest enough powers in the national government. I think at the national level right now, we're really, if you look at Congress and you look at some of the presidential votes, we're really split still among those who think, the answer to our situation is more government versus those who think it's less government.
But, there are people who think that that new constitutional convention you were talking about is a pretty good idea because they find the current document, which hasn't been amended in a long time, to be suffering from hardening of the articles, if you'll pardon the expression, and that maybe it needs more flexibility, maybe it needs to be brought more up to date.
Well, there's certainly many people who have made that argument. I personally think the Constitution is more adaptable than people realize. We've had two particularly long periods in American history, one from 1804 to 1865 and another from 1870 to 1913, where there were no formal amendments, and then all of a sudden you get three to five adopted fairly quickly. And sometimes we want to run ahead and have a convention before we develop a consensus, and sometimes it's actually better to get people a little bit more common understanding of what's wrong before you try to go in and fix things.
There are constitutions in other countries that have looked to the United States as a model but have also included in their own nation's constitutions women's rights and health care as a human right as
right.
opposed to just something you either can afford or you can't.
Right. Most 20th century and I guess what 21st century constitutions there have been have followed a model of what we call positive rights, rights to education, health care, and the like. The U.S. Constitution, for better or worse, primarily is built around the notion of negative rights, which are restraints on government versus entitlements to individual citizens. Now, that doesn't keep such entitlements from being enacted into law, but to go back to what you said earlier, if you have them in the Constitution and you need to make a change, sometimes you end up with less flexibility than you would have with a Constitution like our own.
Dr. John Vial, author of The Men Who Made the Constitution and Dean of the University Honors College at MTSU, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.